We shall now turn to consider the portion, our words in the portion read in Genesis chapter 45. We may read verse 3 just now. Genesis 45, verse 3, and Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph. I am Joseph. Verse 4. And Joseph said unto his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother. And it is that claim, that identity that Joseph here discloses to his brethren that we want to think about for a little. I am Joseph. Now, this was Joseph's name that his mother gave to him when he was born. But when at 30 years of age he was elevated to the position of governor of all Egypt, he was given then an Egyptian name. And yet Joseph here, though he has this powerful name, a name that would be recognized ever throughout Egypt, a name that would require people to bow to him as he passed in his chariot in the street. In Genesis 41, we're told in verse 44, Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah. And this was a name that had a significance and was given to him because Pharaoh recognized that he possessed, as far as Pharaoh was concerned, very special gifts. Because the name, according to scholars, means something like the revealer of secrets, the interpreter of the hidden, or one who speaks for God. And you see, because Joseph had interpreted Pharaoh's dreams, and Joseph made it very clear when he was in the prison interpreting, or before he interpreted the dreams of the baker and the butler, he told them that the interpretation of dreams was from God. It wasn't Joseph who had the ability to do it. It was God who revealed what was dreamt of, its significance. And this is recognized by Pharaoh. But you imagine, as this powerful man, he's been given the ring. Pharaoh has taken his ring off and put it on the finger of Joseph. He has put a gold plate around his neck, clearly indicating the high office that he held. And as he travels around through Egypt, everyone recognizes who he is and what a position he holds in Egypt. Now you can imagine when Joseph's brethren first come down and set eyes upon him, they don't recognize him as the Joseph that they ever knew. They think he is the second in command in the mighty Egyptian Empire. And yet here, whenever Joseph is speaking to them, he says, I am Joseph. That's who I really am. I am not an Egyptian. I am Joseph. And he's going back to his birth. He hasn't forgotten his birth. He hasn't forgotten his upbringing. And this is what he says then to his brethren, I am Joseph, your brother. I still belong to you and you belong to me. Now when Joseph identifies himself before his brethren, he does it at a particular time in his life and in their experiences. Now, when you read right through the book of Genesis, you will discover that almost a quarter of it deals with Joseph. Almost a quarter of the whole book of Genesis is focused around Joseph. He's a very important figure in the Old Testament and in the history of Israel. If I were to ask the younger members of the congregation, even the older members, give me the name of an Old Testament character or person, you might say, well, David, Daniel, Moses. But I would imagine some would say Joseph, because even the children grow up learning about the story of this man, this great man, Joseph, in Egypt. And yet the amazing thing is, when we come to the New Testament, Joseph is barely mentioned. There is plenty about David, there's plenty about Moses, plenty about Abraham. There's hardly any mention. In fact, the name Joseph, the name of this Joseph, only appears 8 times in the New Testament. And 4 of those times are in Acts chapter 7, where he is mentioned in the sermon preached by Stephen. On the other 4 occasions, he's referred to in relation to Jacob, so that it's not really he who's focused on, but Jacob. And he is not presented in the New Testament as a great significant character. And yet, the significance of what he was and what he did cannot possibly be overlooked. But it is set, the story of Joseph is actually set in the story of Jacob and Israel. Joseph only comes in because of what God is doing with Jacob and doing with Israel. And that's why then he is important, so that when we read these words, him saying, I am Joseph, we want to find out something about him. Why does he say this? Why does he identify himself as Joseph? And there are just 5 particulars regarding his life and his work that we would endeavor to focus on. First of all, looking at Joseph, and I might say this, as you probably know by now, I'm never in a hurry to present a well-laid-out sermon with nice, neat points and so on. If I get to 1 point or 2 points or 3 headings, that's what we do. And that's what we will do here. I am Joseph. Joseph the son. What does he say here? I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live? Joseph the son. And then we shall look at him as Joseph the servant. He tells his brethren that God sent him on a mission for a reason down into Egypt for a purpose. He had a service to render in Egypt, but he learned to be a servant before ever he got there. And the third thing that we may note about Joseph, this servant, was a suffering servant. And so we shall consider Joseph, I am Joseph who suffered. And then we may see Joseph as a savior. He makes it clear to his brethren why he's been in Egypt. What he's gone through is so that he might save them as a family and preserve them in the earth. And then lastly, Joseph, I am Joseph the succorer. He tells his brethren here, be not grieved. He knew they were grieved. He says, be not grieved. I will explain everything to you. You will understand better when I explain what I've been here for, what I've been sent to do. First of all then, I am Joseph. And he asked the question, doth my father yet live? He had a particular interest in his father because his father had a peculiar interest in him. Remember who he is? Jacob. Jacob the supplanter. Jacob, the son of Isaac, and Jacob, who robbed his brother, the firstborn, of his firstborn inheritance, the blessing of the firstborn. But he belongs to a peculiar family, this Joseph. If you look at everything that is written about Jacob, he himself is a peculiar character. In many senses, he is a very poor example of a father. And you see this when we look at what happens with Joseph in connection with the other members of his family. When we go back, we see the first mention of Joseph when he's born in verse 24. His mother, of course, is Rachel, Genesis 30, verse 24. She called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. Very interesting to see how many of the patriarchs are actually named not by their fathers, but by their mothers. And this is one of them. But look at the family into which he is born and to which he grows up. Go to chapter 37 of Genesis. What do we read? In verse 1, Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. So this is where Joseph is born, in the land of Canaan. Now we're told in verse 3, Israel, that is Jacob, Israel, loved Joseph more than all his children. That wasn't very wise. He made Joseph his favorite. And the other brothers knew it, and they didn't like it. Now you would think that Jacob would have been wiser to keep harmony and peace among his families, that his family, his children, he would have treated them equally, but he made Joseph his favorite. Now, it is a well-known fact that some parents among their children, they love them all, but just for some reasons, they have maybe a favorite, but they determine not to show it. They know it isn't wise to make other members of their family think, well, he's favored or she's favored above me. But here, Jacob makes it so obvious. He creates problems in his own family, and he creates terrible problems for this son, Joseph. What do we read in verse 4? Verse 3, he loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. Now, there are several references to this coat of many colors. That's one of the things that children grow up remembering. Well, Joseph was the boy with a coat of many colors. But whether it was actually of many colors is debatable, because it really means, it's translated in various ways, it was a coat of particular colors that displayed grandeur, or it was a special garment. In fact, some translate it as, instead of being a coat of many colors, a coat of wide sleeves, meaning that it was not an ordinary garment. It was the garment of a sheikh. It was the garment worn by those who were wealthy, those who were rich, and it would have the finest color. Some think it even means it was stripes of embroidery in the, it was made of the, of expensive material with the best colors that wouldn't fade. And this is the coat that Joseph is given to wear, singling him out, making him obviously the target of the suspicion and the jealousy and the hatred of his brethren. And yet, this is what Jacob did, and you can see the trouble that it caused for Joseph and for his brethren, and sadly for himself. We're told in verse 4, when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him. It was so obvious. And it was as though Jacob wanted the other brethren to know, this boy is special to me. This boy is going to be treated special, and you will recognize him as being special. They hated him, and we're told, could not speak peaceably unto him. What conversations then were in this family? You can just imagine Joseph speaking to his older brothers, and they sarcastically reply. They treat him with disrespect and disdain. It wasn't a very nice atmosphere to be living in. Joseph didn't enjoy a very sweet and harmonious childhood among these brethren. But you see, it gets worse. Verse 5, Joseph dreamed a dream and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. It's getting worse for Joseph. He doesn't enjoy this family's atmosphere nor this family's company. It is a very uncomfortable situation, and we would think of his sufferings down in Egypt, but his sufferings begin in his very own family and in his own home. What do we read? Go down to verse 8. His brethren, because he tells the dreams, his brethren said unto him, shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more. It's getting worse and worse and ever worse. They hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. He dare not even open his mouth. But they hate him. They don't even listen to him. They don't want to hear him. What a start in life. I am Joseph. This is my background. This is my history. This is my family. Then you go down to verse 11 of this same chapter 37. And his brethren envied him. They envy him. They hate him. And they envy him, and envy, according to Proverbs, is cruel. Now this is the This is the home. This is the family. This is the beginning. This is how we find Joseph appearing before us. Our attention is drawn to this man, Joseph. I am Joseph. This is where I come from. This is my childhood. This is my upbringing. But he is not just a son. He is a servant. Now, when he speaks to his brethren, as we said, he points out to them, verse 5 of Genesis 45, "Now therefore," he says, "be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life." God sent me down to Egypt. You may think it was you, but God was behind it. You had your plan, but God had his plan. And he says, "God did send me before you to preserve life." Now, Joseph had no idea when he was journeying to Egypt, this was the reason he was going. You imagine the fear of a young 17-year-old, a young teenager in those days, among strangers, torn away from his father that loved him, torn away from his brethren also that hated him, taken away among strangers on this long journey down to Egypt, not knowing what is going to happen to him. All he can envisage is the marketplace where the traders will come to exchange goods and sell their wares from different parts of the world of that day. And Joseph knows, I'm going to be among those that are up for sale as slaves. What a frightening, terrifying experience awaits Joseph. But now, you see, when he looks back, he can understand so much of it that he couldn't possibly have understood then. And he says, "Be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me." That's all you did. "You sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life." You know, it's a very interesting thing. If you were to get a map of the whole area at the time, and you would follow the journey of Joseph to his brethren, first of all, going back to chapter 37 and verse 2, we read, "These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpha, his father's wives." Now, if you go back, you find they were his concubines. His wives were actually Leah and Rachel, but these are his concubines, and they had four sons between them. And these are the sons that it seems that Joseph keeps company with. And they appear to be separate from the other sons, the other eight sons that Jacob fathered. But when he is called by his father, going down in this chapter 37 to verse 12, we read, "His brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem." Now, Joseph is in Hebron. His father calls him and said to Joseph, verse 13, "Do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them." And he said to him, "Here am I." There's the beginning of his service. Before he goes to serve in Egypt, he's a faithful servant, obedient servant of his own father. His father loved him, and he enjoyed serving his father. The service wasn't always wise. We're told in verse 2 of this chapter that Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Well, that wasn't going to help him very much. That wasn't going to make him appreciated or loved any better by his brethren, because he was a telltale. And he's telling his father what this one's doing and what Dan's doing and what Ephraim's doing. And the father didn't like it, and yet he used Joseph to report to him. So here he says, your brethren are in Shechem feeding the flocks. I want you to go to them and return and tell me how they're getting on, how their flocks are, and so on. Verse 14, he said to him, go, I pray thee, and see whether it be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Now you get a map, and you will see it's about 90 kilometers out over mountainous terrain from Hebron to Shechem. And he would have to walk that, and it was a long journey. But what happens when he gets to Shechem? We're told, verse 15, a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what seekest thou? He said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks, because they weren't in Shechem. He's traveled all this distance, and his brethren aren't there. The man said, they are departed hence, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. Dothan is another 30 kilometers north again. So he has to set off and look for them. Joseph doesn't know what's going on, but God has a plan, and he's working it out perfectly. Now, what do his brethren see when he meets them, when he finds them at Dothan? After they've cast Joseph into a pit, they see these traders, these Midianites coming, because they're in Dothan. You see, his brethren have moved to Dothan, and that was one of the places where one of the main roads in those days for trading from all over the world at that time passed through. And if Joseph had found his brethren at Shechem, there would have been no Midianites. Or whatever they would do with them, they wouldn't be able to sell them to the Midianites on their way to Egypt. And you see how God was planning it all. Joseph had no idea. And he comes expecting his brethren there, because that's where they should have been. But they've moved to Dothan, because God has a plan, and God has a purpose. And there comes these traders on the great trade route, where they would be going with all their goods, their spices, and all their various goods. They're heading for Egypt. And Joseph is there, and his brethren are there. You see how God times everything? See how he fits everything perfectly together in his providence. He works out his perfect plan. And Joseph is sold by the Midianites to an officer of Pharaoh's down in Egypt. Now you just imagine. Just imagine Joseph downcast. There he stands. People are coming to look at him, examine him. Would he be suitable? Can I afford to buy him? Can I take him into my service? My sleeve? That's all he is. That's all he is now. He has left behind his father's house. And now all he is a slave in this foreign land with a foreign culture, with foreign gods. Everything is most strange to him. It was a terrifying experience. And yet he says, God sent me here. God had it all planned. The route was all planned. The traitors were already planned as God was sending me down to Egypt. But when he sent me down to Egypt, he kept fulfilling his plan. And so Potiphar, who is an officer in the household of Pharaoh, purchases Joseph. And Joseph then ends up in the house of Potiphar as a mere slave and a servant. Now what happens? He meets with this wicked woman, Potiphar's wife, who does everything to tempt him into sin. And you might think, if you were Joseph, a young teenager, he's been dealt severely with, he's been treated abysmally, and he's down in Egypt, and he must have passed through his mind, perhaps, God has forsaken me. The God of Jacob, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob that I grew up to be taught about, I grew up to worship, I grew up to believe in, he's just forsaken me, he's abandoned me, he's left me. No one cares for my soul. But what we read is this: the Lord was with Joseph. In all this, the Lord was with Joseph. And the Lord that was with Joseph did not prevent his suffering. He did not prevent it. It was all part of the divine plan of God. And Joseph ends up in prison. And you imagine what must have gone through his young mind. He'd think of his father's love. He'd think of his coat of many colors. And now he's imprisoned among the offenders of the king and the offenders of his officers. And he may well come to the conclusion, God has abandoned me. But we are told the Lord was actually with him. In fact, it's three times it's stressed the Lord was with him. And although the Lord was with him, God didn't prevent the temptations that befell him. And God did not prevent the suffering experiences that he passed through. In the psalm that we sang from Psalm 105, he was put in irons, and the irons pressed into his flesh. He really suffered physically, and he must have suffered mentally as well. In chapter 39, it's stressed there, verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. Look at verse 1. Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him off the hands of the Ishmaelites. You see what Joseph has become. What an experience to be the very delight of his father. And now, He's just a commodity. He's brought so low. He's just a commodity that can be bought and sold. But God's in it all. And the Lord was with Joseph. And it was God who directed Potiphar to buy him, so that he will end up in Potiphar's house. And there his faith in God will be tested. And what does Joseph say? Well, I've forgotten God because God's forgotten me. When he's tempted by Potiphar's wife, what does he say? How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? There's grace for you. Real grace. And a young teenager. I can't sin against God no matter what he's done. No matter what he's purposed. No matter what he's planned and what he's put me through, I cannot sin against God. And Joseph, then we're told the Lord was with him, verse 3. The master saw that the Lord was with him. Isn't that something? It wasn't just that the Lord was with him. Potiphar could see. God is with this young man. It's obvious. I can see it, the way he behaves, the way he conducts himself, the way he does his work. I can see that God is with him. And you can see again in the same chapter, Joseph ends up in prison. Without getting into all the details, verse 20 of Chapter 39, Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph. Doesn't the Lord do some strange things that appears to us? Doesn't he do things that naturally we wouldn't want to happen? Doesn't he do things that are inexplicable to us? And yet he does them. Because he's in control. Now you just think, as we've been going through Jeremiah, the people that we're talking about, the people that Jeremiah was ministering to, where did they come from? How did they exist? This is part of that story, God doing his great work of redemption. You know, in many evangelical circles, men give the impression they are orthodox, they're really evangelical, and the proof of it is, you see, they state, we preach Christ and him crucified. Now, we would be thinking, well, isn't that really good that they do? And it is. But if that's where they stop, that's not the gospel. And I hear people say, and have heard them over the years, oh, take us to the cross. Take us to the dying Redeemer. Take us to the work of atonement. If Jesus Christ was crucified and died as the sin bearer, what does that mean? The sentence of death has been carried out against him. But what is it that actually makes the atonement? You see, it isn't just a matter of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, being the sin bearer, being the substitute. It requires much, much more than that. You go to the Old Testament, to the types and the ceremonies. What happened in the Day of Atonement? The high priest, first of all, went to the altar. And there he made a sacrifice, offered a sacrifice, first of all for himself, for his own sins, and then for the sins of the people. Now what did he do? He offered a sacrifice. There was a substitutionary death. Instead of the high priest dying, the oxen died. Instead of the people dying, the lamb was sacrificed. There was the substitute. But what did the priest do after that? He took the blood from the sacrifice and he went within the veil, into the Holy of Holies, into the immediate presence of God as he presenced himself there in the camp. He could not go without blood, nor without incense, but he had to go with blood. And the children of Israel, they may stand as a congregation and observe him offering the sacrifice. But they know he must do more than that. He must take the blood of the sacrifice and he must sprinkle it on the mercy seat. And God is requiring that blood. Now in his priestly garments, around the hem of his priestly garments, what makes a noise? As he's moving around, the people can't see him. He's behind the veil. But they hear the sound of the bells and the pomegranates. As he moves, they know he's alive. And Adershim, one of the great Hebrew scholars, tells us that they had a rope around one of the legs of the priest, that if he would die, then they'd be able to drag him out from the Holy of Holies because no one dare go into it. And you see, the Israelites stand, they can't see inside that veil. They dare not go in. But the representative goes, he is offered the sacrifice. The victim has been slain. The substitute has been offered to God. But the blood then has to be presented to God, and the proof that is that God accepts it as an atoning sacrifice is in the life of the high priest returning to the people. And they know then God has accepted it. He has approved of it. He has accepted it. And you see, the full gospel takes us beyond the cross to the throne, to a living Savior. And remember this, if he was resurrected, even that isn't enough. If Jesus died and he rises again, some think, well, that's it. That's the work completed. No, it is not. Because if he was resurrected, it would prove his deity. It would prove indeed his divine power. He's really God. But he must ascend on high and enter within the veil for the justification of his people. He must present that blood and God must accept it. And how do we know that it is accepted? Pentecost proves that it was accepted. The Spirit of God descends as sent by the Father, by the Son. The Holy Spirit has been sent. I will send to you another Comforter. Why does he have the authority to do that? Because he's accepted by the Father. His work is accepted. And you see, when we come to consider portions of the Old Testament, some people think they're irrelevant. Why bother? Why waste time going over these the histories of these characters and so on. Some of you will have heard of Jonathan Edwards, the great preacher of the past. And he wrote a book, The History of Redemption. Now you will get lots of books about redemption. Various aspects of redemption. What did Edwards write? The history of redemption. Not just redemption. But redemption has a history. And if we're to understand redemption, we need to know the history. And Edwards seeks to trace the whole history of redemption from the fall, right through the Old Testament, right through the New Testament, to the final glorification of the church. And everything that we read in the Old Testament is bound up with that history of redemption. And Joseph is part of that history. And therefore he is an important figure. But the very fact, as I said, there's so little mention of him in the New Testament, means that God intends us to focus on him in the Old Testament. That's where he fits in. That's where he has to be. That's where God has put him. And therefore, when we read, God the Lord was with him, the Lord was with him for a reason. He was sustaining him. He was taking him and carrying him through every difficulty and every trial. And where is he now? He's in prison. And the Lord was with Joseph. But you can see he's still a servant. He served his father. He comes down into Egypt. He becomes the servant and the slave of Potiphar. He ends up in prison, and what are we told? Verse 22 of Genesis 39, the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison, and whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it, so he became a servant even in the prison. God was teaching Joseph what it was to be a mere servant. He's been a son. But he has to learn what it is to be a servant, to be submissive to the mind and the will and the purposes of God, no matter what they be. Now, it would have been very pleasant for Joseph to continue serving his father, going to see the sheep, coming back to his father, sitting, talking to him, relating to him all the information about his brethren and about their flocks and so on. But God requires Joseph to serve him in Potiphar's house, and he's going to test him in that service. And then God overrules so that he ends up in prison to serve God there. But then we're told in the chapter 40, as things progress, that when Joseph is in prison, you think of it, how timely. God has everything timed. There are two prisoners, and they both dream dreams, and they're both distressed. So Joseph renders a very particular and peculiar service to them because they were downcast. Joseph, verse 6 of chapter 40, came in unto them in the morning and looked upon them, and behold, they were sad. So he inquired what the reason was, and then in verse 8, we have dreamed a dream, they said, and there is no interpreter of it. And Joseph said unto them, do not interpretations belong to God? Now you go back to the dreams of Joseph. And you might think, well, Joseph could have saved himself a lot of trouble if he hadn't gone and told the dreams to his brethren. Would have saved him a lot of heartache and a lot of pain, and they wouldn't have hated him so much. They detested him for his dreaming, and when indeed he appears, when he catches up with them in Dothan, they saw him coming at a distance, and they despisingly said, "Here comes," they called him the master dreamer. It was as though all he does is spend his life dreaming. We have to work. We have to look after the flocks. He's just a spoilt brat. That's what really they thought of him. And Joseph goes down into Egypt, and he ends up in the service of Potiphar, then in the service of the prison officer. But then Joseph, you see, is faced here with the opportunity to speak in behalf of God. He says, well, interpretations of dreams, well, they're from God. So only God can tell you what these dreams mean. But God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph, and God gave Joseph the interpretation of these dreams. Joseph didn't do it in his own. Now, when Joseph would think back to the dreams that he had, that he told to his brothers, you just imagine why they were so angry. Who does this upstart think he is? Imagine, he thinks he's telling us that we're going to bow down to him, that he's going to lord it over us. Who does he think he is? And they hated him, and they intended to get rid of him. And when he comes, and you can imagine how painful it must have been. We're told in the Psalms of his agony, and they themselves, although they didn't know that Joseph knew them when they were down in Egypt, and when they see things are not going to plan for them, we're told in chapter 42, verse 23, they knew not that Joseph understood them. There they were talking away in their own language. And here's this mighty master in Egypt. He's an Egyptian. He doesn't speak our language. He doesn't know our language. He doesn't come from our country or our culture. And Joseph is listening. And he hears these remarkable confessions. In verse 21 of chapter 42, they said one to another, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul." My, my, my. You can just imagine this young teenager pleading with them, begging them, "Please, please, do not kill me. Do not cast me in this pit. Do not abandon me. Do not leave me." He pleads with them, and they remember it. We saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us. You can imagine, almost on his knees, begging, "Please, please, don't do this." They didn't care. And you can see the effects that it has psychologically upon Joseph. And we read, they went on, "And we would not hear, therefore is this distress come upon us." My, it takes time sometimes, doesn't it? God doesn't need to be in a hurry. And men's sins can catch up with them eventually, even though they don't expected. And here they are realizing what happened them years ago. God hasn't forgotten it, and he's now punishing us for it. Reuben answered them, saying, "Speak I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and ye would not hear. Therefore, behold, all his blood, also his blood is required." And they knew not that Joseph understood. Imagine Joseph listening to this, and the pain of it is all coming back. But now he realizes something. They themselves know they're beginning to pay for it. We're told that when they put Joseph into the pit, they sat down and they ate. They put him in the pit and he's pleading. You can imagine he's crying out to them to have mercy, to deliver him, and they just carry on feasting and ignore him. And now they are paying for it. But look at what we read concerning Joseph and his attitude. Think of what's going on in his mind. What affects him psychologically? In chapter 41, Joseph is given a wife by Pharaoh, and from that wife he has two sons. And we read in verse 50 of chapter 41, unto Joseph was born two sons before the years of famine came, which Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On, bare unto him. Now listen. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. For God, said he, hath made me to forget all my toil and my father's house. You can feel the pain. I never want to see my brothers again. I never want anything to do with them, with what they put me through. The agony, the pain, the anguish. They're merciless. Actions selling me and their very brother. You imagine when Joseph says, "I am Joseph, your brother." What memories that would bring back. And Joseph comes of this mind, "God hath comforted me. He's made me forget my toil. He's given me a wife. He's given me position. He's given me two sons. And this has enabled me to forget the pain and the anguish, but also to forget my father's house." It was as though Joseph doesn't want anything to do with his family ever again. They so ill-treated him, and it's as though he's finished with them. And when he heard them speaking, heard them confessing. Reuben is confessing, "We had no mercy, we were brutal, we were cruel. He was our young brother, and look what we did to him." And they didn't know that Joseph understood them. But Joseph doesn't want anything to do with them anymore. And yet, you see the grace. You see the grace in Joseph whenever he's speaking to them and he says, "I am Joseph. I am Joseph, your brother. I went through so much. I wanted to forget all about you. You put me through so much. And I cried to you and I pled with you. And you treated me as a criminal. You had no mercy, you had no love, you had no compassion. And when God providentially provided me with these comforts in life, I decided I will forget all about you. And yet when they appear, Joseph can't. And he says, I am Joseph. I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt. And the reason I'm here is to save you and your families. That's what Joseph tells them. But then, as Joseph suffers down in Egypt, and he may have puzzled at times, why is it? How is it? What does it mean? We're told until his word came in Psalm 105, the word of the Lord tried him. That was a real trial for his faith, hanging on to God, hanging on to his promise. He hadn't anything else. He has no father to hold on to now. He has no sympathetic brothers to hold on to. He's got no Potiphar admiring him to hold on to him. He's got no one but God. What a blessed position to be brought into. No one but God. But the Lord was with him. And as Paul says, if God be for us, who can be against us? And there he was in the midst of all his pain and all his anguish. And God was still with him. And God was still holding on to him. And God was still intending to use him. And you see that here in chapter 45, when he speaks to his brethren in verse 5, remember he has listened to them, he has heard them, he knows what they've been thinking, he knows what they've been saying. And he could have thought, well, it serves you, brethren, right. I'm glad that you feel a little bit of pain. I'm glad that you're suffering. You don't even know the half of what I've suffered. So I'm glad you're experiencing a little pain. I'm glad you're suffering now. Joseph said, I am still your brother. I am not an Egyptian. This is not my home. And what does he tell them to do? To take his bones when they're departing out of Egypt? They're to take his bones with them because he belongs to them. There was a blessed bond that even all that hatred and all that animosity and all that turmoil and all that pain could not break, because God intended to make a mighty nation down in Egypt. Now, whenever here in chapter 45, Joseph discloses who he is, he tells them, verse 5, God sent me before you to preserve life. What does that mean? God knew you'd be coming. God knew you'd be coming to Egypt. God knew the day you would be coming to Egypt. Now, what did Pharaoh do whenever they came? He said, you're spies. And he even imprisoned one of them. And he could have imprisoned a lot of them. He was demonstrating his mighty power and his authority. Now you imagine it hadn't been Joseph that was there. The famine would have struck in Egypt as much as Canaan. But they've been storing up for 7 years. They've been making all this provision. And God has Moses, or has Joseph there ahead of his brethren. He knew they'd be coming. Well, what would be the point of them coming if there's nothing for them to come to? So Joseph says, God sent me before you. God sent me before you not to just serve Potiphar or to serve the Egyptians or to serve Pharaoh, but he sent me for your sakes. You see where Joseph now is fitting in? This is God's Israel. These are the tribes of Israel. And God sends Joseph before them in order to make preparation for their coming. And he says in verse 7, God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth. What a marvelous revelation that was. Where would the promise that God made to Abraham, where would it have gone if Joseph hadn't been there? You see what God was doing? He's preserving his church. He's preserving his people. And he sends Joseph ahead. And Joseph now recognizes, God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. The glorious God of the covenant was working out a great plan. The whole scheme of redemption. This is the history of redemption. And God will one day have this nation that he promises formed down in Egypt, and then he will bring this nation, and as we read earlier today, they will be his nation. The wonderful works of the Lord. Joseph is never spoken of as a type of Christ, a figure of Christ. There's nothing of that. He's fixed in the Old Testament. And yet, as we shall see more, there are so many that we can see patterns, as it were, of the Savior, because this is part of what? The history of redemption. This is part of Christ's history, part of the Redeemer's history. So it's important. And we see that no matter how impossible things are with men, and no matter how mysterious, God is perfectly in control. And how many have drawn comfort and consolation when they've been passing through dark valleys, when they've been in the misery that Joseph experienced, and they see God was with him, and they've taken comfort. I may be imprisoned, I may be in chains, I may be fettered, I may be suffering, but Joseph did that, and God was with him. God was with him all the way through for a purpose, but the time is gone and we must leave it. We shall come back to it in the will of the Lord. God willing, let us conclude. Gracious and eternal God, we give thee thanks for thy word, for thy mighty workings, the workings of redemption to redeem a people, a number which no man can number, out of every tribe and tongue and nation. We thank thee for thy workings in the life of Joseph and in the experience of Jacob. We thank thee that thou art God thyself alone, ruling and reigning to do what pleases thee, that thy name should be exalted and glorified. Bless thy truth to us. Pardon us for Christ's sake. Amen.